Hello and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people who are known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Sina Bazila Hickey, and today we have a special episode to celebrate 5 years of Hudson Mohawk Magazine and our stellar producers who are the power behind this program. So today I'm joined by two fabulous people. Bria.
Hi, I'm Bria Barthel.
And I'm Blaze Bryant.
Thank you for joining me to showcase some of your work and to talk about the experience of working on this community radio program. I'd like to start with some background, and I'd like to start with Blaze because you have a background in radio. So can you tell us a little bit about what is your training and why did you decide to join Hudson Mohawk Magazine?
Okay, I'll start with the training piece first. It started when I was in college. I went to the College of St. Rose here in Albany, have a bachelor's degree in broadcast journalism. I've interned for a local radio station. I've participated with other community radio stations, went to the New School Center for Media before that was defunct. Why I wanted to be a part of Hudson Mohawk Magazine and be here with the two of you at the Sanctuary for Independent Media is because now I live in Troy, and I think it's important for me as someone who's wanted to do radio since I was 10 to be part of a station that is where I live.
Thank you, Blaze. And Bria, you do not have a background in radio. Well, why did you join Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and how's the learning curve been?
Well, my background isn't in radio, but I have a background in public speaking. I taught public speaking at UAlbany and at RPI for decades. And I actually took a video production course with Branda Miller back in 92 or 93. Branda, one of the co-founders of The Sanctuary. So I was interested in The Sanctuary from the beginning. I've been a social activist my whole life on a minor level, not anywhere near the kinds of stuff that many people involved with the station do. But I have a real strong community connection, and I like to learn about community resources and share that information with others. Eileen Javier first got me involved with the radio program, and it's been a great opportunity for me. The learning curve, I had been editing video a bit for my public speaking class and for presentations, but it was learning a slightly different software and also piecing together things rather than just getting it from one format to another. But it's been fun. You've been great help, Sina, and it's been great to learn a little more about audio production.
You know, if I could just jump off of a point that you made, Bria, about social advocacy and activism, is I'm someone who does a lot of disability rights advocacy because I am a person with a disability. I was born completely blind. You may have just heard some jingling off mic. That's my seeing eye dog Flash making his appearance and saying hi. It's important for people with disabilities to be part of the community and be part of communities that are highlighting issues and want to make the necessary changes to make the world a more equitable place to live.
And advocating doesn't need to be super boring. We have a lot of fun on, you guys co-host Monday nights, which replays on Tuesday mornings. How important is it to find this community here? And can you also talk about more from your co-hosting experience? What are some of the stories that you like to hear?
So one of the pieces that we're going to hear in a little bit is one I did about the Disability Day of Mourning, which is on March 1st of every year. And the reason for the Disability Day of Mourning is to highlight the unfortunate reality of disabled people being killed by parents or guardians just because the person is disabled. There are very few stations that would want to cover this issue because of how, frankly, disturbing it is. And the radio landscape as a whole has become more corporate, and issues like this just tend not to be covered. So it's important for me to be a part of the station, I think, to bring these issues to the media landscape beyond what you see on the brief news clips or read in the paper.
And I want to pick up on that in terms of, I also have a little bit of background in disability. I worked in a program for developmentally disabled, a residential program for developmentally disabled for New York State back in 1974, and was frankly appalled by what I saw there in many ways. So I was delighted to be working with Blaze and to get another perspective on issues. And for me, it's disability advocacy isn't my main focus, but volunteerism and the value of nonprofit organizations is critical in my eyes. And those usually don't get much play on larger media, except when they're having a fundraiser. And for one of my focuses here on in my segments is, what are the different organizations and resources? How can people get help when they need it? What might be at the library or at the community loan fund or at other organizations that can help people lead lives? And social justice is so critical. Environmental justice is so critical. And I've one of my earliest connections with the radio program, not the sanctuary, but the radio program, was driving to RPI years ago and hearing Megan Marone's segments with David Borden and hearing how much she enjoyed talking about physics. So it's the opportunity to cover stories that would otherwise not get covered is important.
I learned very quickly when I was in journalism classes at St. Rose about the value of community journalism. It is such an important and essential aspect of the media, because as organizations that should not have a political bias, but do, it's important that members of the community can bring their stories, their experiences, their time, their talents to a station such as the Sanctuary for Independent Media, or I should say an organization such as the Sanctuary for Independent Media, because without community journalism, how are we informed about what is truly going on locally?
We're going to head into some of our segments to hear some examples of your work. Bria, we're going to start with your piece. Could you just set it up very quickly for us?
Yeah, and actually, to be clear, Sina, I knew, was going to pick this piece. I recorded it at a food drop, a food distribution event sponsored by Catholic Charities. And I was a little nervous about the audio on this because it was recorded outside with a lot of activity going on. And I thought, oh, how do I edit out these background sounds? And one of the first comments that you made, Sina, after hearing it was, I love that we were right on site. And this is one of your best pieces. So we're going to be hearing from Sister Betsy Van Dusen, who at that point was running the food drops and is now executive director of Catholic Charities of the Diocese of Albany.
This is Bria Barthel for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and today I'm live at a mass food distribution program held in Troy by Catholic Charities and a number of other sponsors, and talking with Sister Betsy Van Dusen, Director of Community Partnerships for Catholic Charities. Sister Betsy, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Bria. It's great to be with you.
And can you tell us something about the wonderful programs that you do for food distribution?
Sure. We started doing food in November of 2018, before the pandemic, in a program called CCMU, stands for Mobile Outreach Vehicle Extension, because we said there are people who are out there who don't really have access to service, and if we could go to them, then all the better. But we said, where are they going to know about us? And we said, all right, well, if we feed them, they will come. So we started doing mass food distributions once a month in Fulton and Montgomery counties, because that was the highest incidence of poverty in the 14 counties covered by the Diocese of Albany by Catholic Charities. So we did that until March of 2020, and the food bank came to us and said, you've been doing this, you know how to do this, will you do it more? And so we really expanded our footprint. So now we have been in 10 of the 14 counties covered by Catholic Charities, and we do a lot in Albany, Rensselaer, Schenectady counties.
And most of our listeners are in Albany, Schenectady, and Troy, so perhaps you can talk specifically about the programs in this area?
Absolutely. So in Rensselaer County, we typically move around to different places. We've been in Rensselaer at the Columbia Turnpike. Today, we're at the Italian Community Center. We've been at the Lansingburg Boys and Girls Club. We've been in Grafton State Park, and we've been at Hudson Valley Community College. So we tend to typically sort of move around in Troy. In Albany, we have some set places, 230 Green Street in the south end of Albany, Metropolitan Baptist Church on 2nd Street in Albany, 833 Broadway, which is downtown in Albany, Macedonia Baptist Church, also in Albany, and then in Schenectady, we have been at the Crosstown Plaza.
And that's a lot of different locations. How often do you circle around to each of them?
Typically, we do 10 mass drops a month, so most of those sites are every month.
And I'm looking around at what's being given out today, and I see both non-perishable food like cereal and canned juices, but also I'm delighted to see perishable food, produce and milk and vegetables. Can you say something about the kinds of foods you usually have?
We typically have a very well-balanced, very nutritious bag of food. What comes varies depending upon what the food bank has in at the time. The Regional Food Bank is our huge partner in this. We could not do this food without them, and so we're so grateful. They access their food from the United States Department of Agriculture, from a program called Nourish New York, which was put in during the pandemic to keep New York farmers farming, and also local wholesalers and retailers. So our grocery stores that we shop at, Hannaford, Walmart, ShopRite, Price Chopper, those folks, when they have stuff that's what they call close to code, they send it to the food bank. It's packaged by, repackaged by volunteers there, and then it goes out to food pantries and soup kitchens and then these drive-thrus.
And I saw in the email asking for volunteers to come here that we should come at 8:15 and distribution would start at 9:30. So I figured I can come at 9 and there's not much to be done. And boy, was I wrong. Tell us about what volunteers do and how you can volunteer.
Absolutely. Anybody's always welcome. And there's something for everybody to do. So the pallets show up here typically about 8:15 before the volunteers come. And we get them set up knowing how much of each piece was going to go in. So if we have 720 bananas and we're packing for 500, then we put in one to begin and then we switch to two.
That's bunches of bananas, not a banana.
That's right, bunches of bananas. And so depending on what the number is, the quantity changes. And so we try to make it so whatever our target number is, we have the food pretty much balance out to that target. So volunteers help put food on tables so other volunteers can walk by and pack bags and boxes and prepare them to go out in cars. And then volunteers also register cars that are driving through and also load the cars with the food that's going by. And when folks come to pick up food, we just simply ask, how many households are you picking up for? How many people in each household? And what's your zip code? And the reason we do that is at the end of the day, we want to know how many people have we served. And I can say that so far in the pandemic, we've served over 350,000 people out here in parking lots.
Hold on, let's do that number again. 350,000 people or families?
350,000 people.
In the space of a couple years.
Yes, since March of 2020.
That's a lot of food you're giving out.
It's a lot of food. It's about 3.5 million pounds of food.
Million pounds. Okay. I started out by putting the bags of food in the car, and it didn't quite feel like 350 million pounds, but it certainly was a little heavy. But there's also other tasks that people can do, like putting in boxes of cereal. Even I could do that.
Exactly. And one of the great things, sometimes we have children out here during school breaks and those kind of things. We have older folks who can't lift a lot of things, but they can put hard-boiled eggs in a bag, or they can put cereal in a car, or they can put lettuce in a box. So there are things for people to do. If you want to come, please come. But we do suggest that you come at 8:15 because we have a circle that explains. That's when the work really happens. There's a circle. We go through what's happening. Where does the food come from? We welcome anybody who's new. We remind people to sign in. And then we get started. And then when we're finished packing, we have great big green tarps out here. And that's our target. All the food goes on those tarps. And then we start the cars coming through. We get the registrars ready, folks get the loaders get next to the cars, and off we go.
Now, I'm looking around, and it looks like I'd estimate about 40 people here maybe working. Of those, how many are staff and how many are volunteers?
We just have two staff out here. Everybody else is a volunteer.
And this site today is co-sponsored by the Labor Council?
Capital District Area Labor Federation, yep.
And tell me about some of the other services that you provide and other organizations that you collaborate with.
Mm-hmm. So truth is, we have some athletes from RPI. We have a whole bunch of folks from the city of Troy here. We had a contractor across the street working on a house, and he sent his three of his workers over here to help because he saw what was going on and he wanted to come. We have lots of other labor people. We have church people who come. We heard about it a long time ago, heard about it once, and want to come on out and participate and volunteer in the effort. And truth is, anybody is welcome. We say, come on, you want to come on out. If you want to just come and see what's going on, come on. What we find is if you come out to look, you can't help but jump in. We're more than happy to have you. And if you want to find out where we're going to be, if you just go on the Catholic Charities Albany website, on the front page is the schedule for CC Move. And as I said, CC Move stands for Mobile Outreach Vehicle Extension. And so in addition to the work here in Mass Drops, we also typically distribute materials so people can reach out to us to say, you know, I need help applying for Social Security. I need help to figure out how to do my resume. I need help with my benefits. I need help to find a job. I need help getting my medical stuff straightened out. And so we have caseworkers who are able to assist with that.
And that's here on site during the food
distribution? No, we give information and then they can call us to do that.
And can you give us the website slowly? Because it looks like there's a lot of letters put together there.
So it's www, and it's, so what it would be Catholic Charities, Roman Catholic Diocese of Albany.org. So CCRCDA.org.
And we have another minute or so. Is there anything else that you think our listeners would especially want to know or be interested in? Or I suspect that you might take monetary donations as well as volunteers?
We certainly would. You can do that on our website as well. You also can send a check to Catholic Charities in Albany. You can just find that on the website. If you stop by and you want to make a donation here, I'll gratefully put it in my pocket and turn it in. But the truth is that we can't do this without the help of many, many volunteers. This effort has only happened, all those people have been fed only because of the willingness of people to come out in any weather. Today we have sort of a balmy day, it's 30. Some days it's colder than that. And so despite that, we have people who come out, they bundle up, they come on out to help their neighbors. And the thing I say is the most important thing that we do out here is to be kind. Our world just needs more kindness. And so we don't make any judgments about who's driving in, what kind of car are they driving, or any of those things. Because as I say, always in the circle, we simply don't know the story. We simply do not know the story of anybody who's here, out here volunteering, or anybody who's going to drive through. And our only task is to be kind and to give away this food.
And to be clear, you don't have to pre-register, you don't have to give personal information, you don't have to be income eligible. It's whoever comes and says, I want food, you give food to.
Correct. And what we know is that many, many, many people take food to their neighbors, take food to people that they know who work, who won't be able to come get food. So other people, this effort has allowed people to help one another, to really give a helping hand in a way that they maybe wouldn't have been able to otherwise.
So thank you, Sister Betsy. This is Bria Barthel for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, talking with Sister Betsy Van Dusen, the Director of Community Partnerships with Catholic Charities of the Diocese of Albany. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing in the community.
And thank you, Bria.
Bria, that piece really stood out to me the first time that we played it on the radio. And you mentioned beforehand your trepidation with the background noise. How did you feel like you've grown through that experience and been able to utilize those on the scene reporting?
I've had a few people comment that they like it. My next piece is going to be at the library. And so we hear the pages turning in the book, and I tried to cut those out. And people said, oh, I love when she flips the pages when she's reading. And so I've gotten more confident that people are going to appreciate the background sounds.
I mean, I'll just say for my own 2 cents quickly, as a blind person, radio is ear theater, and there is something to be said for natural sounds, and I look forward to hearing the pages turn in the book. can't help but think of Bob Seger. So we'll just move on to my piece here. As I said a few minutes ago, we're going to be talking about the Disability Day of Mourning, which is a day, it's March 1st every year, where the disability community comes together to mourn the lives lost because disabled people were killed by people responsible for their care. Here's my conversation with Katie Carroll from Aging New York. Katie, welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Thanks for joining me. Disability Day of Mourning is not a topic that gets a lot of media coverage. Tell people why this is so important.
Absolutely, and thank you for having me, Blaze. So the Disability Day of Mourning is an opportunity to come together and acknowledge people who have been murdered by family or other caregivers, disabled people who have been murdered by family or other caregivers. We're talking about people of all ages, genders, races, disability types, and all over the world.
It really is just, it's unfathomable to think why anyone would murder a disabled person because they're viewed as a burden, and yet the, I don't want to say mass killing of disabled people, but because it is non-discriminatory, as you just said, why do these things happen?
That's a really interesting question, Blaze. So you use the word unfathomable. I also think it's unfathomable. However, plenty of people don't think it's unfathomable. And when we look at particularly media coverage of these murders, we tend to see a pattern. And I would like to refer people to the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, who really helps make the Disability Day of Mourning happen. And the Anti-Filicide Toolkit goes into a lot of this. But basically, when we look at the media coverage of these murders, we see a disturbing trend, one in which the murderers are often cast as the victims. We see community members coming out talking in support of the murderers, lightened sentencing, reasons given, all kinds of reasons given for why their actions were justified in some way. Those reasons are often things like the disabled person was a burden to them. They're better off dead. They just, things like that. And so unfortunately it's not unfathomable. And this day of mourning is not just, it's not just a vigil, but it's an educational opportunity. It's meant to bring awareness to this really disturbing trend.
For sure. Katie Carroll from the Association of Aging New York joining me, Blaze Bryant, here on Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Why March 1st?
I don't know.
Because it really is interesting. I mean, at least when you kind of break it down here in New York's sphere of things, because that's a month away from when the state budget is passed, even though that's not how it works in most states. But it certainly is interesting that we celebrate it on March 1st, which really, in the years that I've been doing disability advocacy with you, really seems to be the beginning of the sprint to the legislators and other elected officials to voice what we are for, what we oppose, and frankly, what we need.
On the topic of, so you mentioned the state budget and state activity, and I have two thoughts about that. One is that I do think part of the Disability Day of Mourning is meant to get away from this idea that these murders are justified when people have a lack of services. And I believe, and I think many other people believe, that there is a significant lack of services and support and funding behind those things for people with disabilities. However, plenty of people who do not have adequate services do not murder their family members or the people who rely upon them. So I think we can do both things. We can bring attention to the fact that it is never okay. It is never justified to murder someone with a disability because they have a disability or because you view them as a burden. And we can simultaneously advocate for better resources. And when it comes to action, or you mentioned state, there are a couple things that people can do to advocate to fight against this trend. One would be calling out the media when they in their judgments about the person who was murdered or the murderer themselves. We need to call out instances of victim blaming, of justification. We also need to be vigilant, and if we think that someone is in danger, if someone is at risk of abuse, we need to know where to go to report those things, and prevent harm to our disabled siblings.
Absolutely, and really the only time, at least in recent memory, where the murder of disabled people has been in the spotlight is because of places like the Albany, or I should say the Times Union, since they now cover the Hudson Valley, have really shined a spotlight on what happened in nursing homes because of the executive orders and the policies of the former governor. Yet I highly doubt that is going to get the same amount of play on Tuesday when we have the Disability Day of Mourning. You know, you also have an attorney background or a law background. So, you know, kind of from that lens, what can the disability community do, or really the public in general do, to make sure that the light on this issue continues to be illuminated? As and having been to a Disability Day of Mourning, the list seems nearly endless in terms of the people who are killed.
Yes, and listeners can go to disability-memorial.org, where a list is kept of people that we know of who have been who are victims of filicide, and you can see there just the diversity of people who have been murdered in this way. I work at the Association on Aging in New York, so I'll just highlight one possible answer to your question, which is really promoting understanding and awareness around elder abuse, and arming ourselves with the resources to recognize symptoms and patterns of abuse and knowing what to do about them.
Yeah, absolutely. And it really is such an important topic. Aging New York is working on the Disability Day of Mourning here locally with the New York Association on Independent Living and Not Dead Yet. How can people find out more information and sign up for the event Tuesday, which begins at 3:30? It is a Zoom webinar, so how can people find out more information about the event itself?
So I'm just going to direct people to the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network website. Just go ahead and do a web search for that and the Disability Day of Mourning. And they have a whole page there where you can find a vigil near you, and you can get in contact with that vigil that way. They'll have the Facebook page and all of that information.
Absolutely. And that website, I do believe, is asan.org, if I'm spouting this off the top of my head correctly, which, you know, never a guarantee with me.
Well, actually, I'll give it to you. So it's autisticadvocacy.org. autismadvocacy.org.
Okay, autisticadvocacy.org. You can find out more information wherever you're listening and get involved with the Disability Day of Mourning. Katie Carroll from Aging New York, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. Really appreciate it.
And thank you.
There's so much to absorb through that conversation and take away from it. And it's really giving a perspective, an underreported perspective on what we don't hear.
One of the things I like about that is that it points out that even when disability stories get covered in the mainstream press, it's from very specific viewpoints. And we don't often hear the viewpoints of the disabled people themselves or of people saying, let's look at the other side of this. So I really appreciate you doing that story.
Well, you're very welcome. And frankly, it's a story that, or something that even in our own community, sometimes it doesn't, when I say our own community, I mean the disability community, doesn't get the attention that it deserves unless it's right around March 1st when the Disability Day of Mourning is. And it's just frankly such a sad event. It's one of those things that after the Disability Day of Mourning, you're mentally just unable to do anything else. At least that's how I feel, because it's just so gosh darn unacceptable.
Do you feel like the press is doing a little bit better in not only showcasing news from an ableist lens?
I think the press is doing better both in terms of having a disability perspective incorporated in their stories, as well as the language that they use in their stories. Thankfully, the wheelchair-bound phrase is largely going away, which is just cringeworthy, because unless you are literally chained to your wheelchair, you are not wheelchair-bound. It's frankly inaccurate, and I'm glad that disgusting language seems to be in the bad part of the history books.
Well, thank you so much for that. We do have two more pieces coming. But for those of you just tuning in, my guests are Bria Barthel and Blaise Bryant and Flash. And you are listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. So our next segment, this is one of the first in an ongoing series that you started, Bria. Book enthusiast, going to the library. What should listeners know about this series, and why do you go back every month to continue it?
I love books. My house is decorated in books. Piles and piles and piles. There's a Japanese word for piles of unread books, and I would need to know the plural, the multi-plural of that. And libraries are just such wonderful community resources, not just for the books, but for everything else they do, the services, the museum passes, everything. So I was delighted when librarians at Troy Public Library said they would be open to monthly segments. So it combines book recommendations as well as information on activities and services. This segment we're going to hear is the first session I did with Carol Roberts, the Young People's Services Librarian. I love her. I love Stephanie Dudek, who used to do the adult services. I love the new guest, Chloe Whitaker, who took over the adult services piece. But Carol Roberts has such a wonderful reading voice. It's clear she's a young kid's speaker. And sometimes I just want to go in and say, this is Bria Barthel, and I'm handing the mic to Carol for 10 minutes.
Hi, I'm Bria Barthel, and today I'm talking about books with Carol Roberts, the Young People's Services Librarian at Troy Public Library. So Carol, welcome, and thanks for taking time to talk with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Can you tell me something about the Young People's Services here at Troy Public Library?
Sure. We provide services for young people up to age 18. So we have things for preschoolers, elementary students, early teens and young adults.
And I think you said something when we were talking before about you have services for kids zero through teenage. Tell me about working with zero-year-old kids.
Well, future parents often come and start looking at books, and I encourage them to come and read to the child. And in non-pandemic times, we provide programs like Story Times, which are really for parents and kids to show them how to, for example, read a book to a child. Many people don't realize that if you don't hold the book so it's slanted toward the child, the kid probably can't see the illustrations, which is so important to the story with picture books.
Well, speaking of not being able to see the illustrations, I see quite a lovely pile of books you have brought to tell our listeners about, and unfortunately, they won't be able to see the illustrations either. So we're taping this in early November, which is National Native American Heritage Month, and Carol has been nice enough to select a number of books related to that. So take it away, Carol.
Well, I had to cut down my pile because, like asking a parent to pick their favorite child, it's very hard for a librarian, especially a children's librarian, to choose just a few books. And my favorite, of course, I think are the picture books. They're wonderful stories, but visually they are so enthralling. And I have two here. One is called We Are Water Protectors, and it won the Caldecott Award for Children's Literature. That's given by the American Library Association, and it focuses on picture books. And part of what goes into the decision-making is a panel looks at how the illustrations help propel the story. And this book is a wonderful example of that. Bright watercolor illustrations, beautiful blues, brilliant oranges. But it's a story about, as you can imagine from the title, it's about the water protectors on Native land. And, for example, one of the passages, they describe the black snake that's coming, and that, of course, is a metaphor for the oil. And it focuses on the fact that Native Americans have often been recognized as being stewards of the earth and taking care of things such as the four-legged, the two-legged, the plants, trees, rivers, lakes, and things which they consider to be part of all of us.
It's a beautiful book. I think you could hear the pages flipping, and I think it's because she saw how eager I was to see all of the beautiful colors and pictures. So listeners, you need to come and look at the book, We Are Water Protectors. What other books do you have for us?
Oh, I have another one called Birdsong, and this is a finalist for the Governor General's Literary Award, and that's a Canadian award for literature, and it's called Birdsong, and it's the story of a child's coming to terms with loss. It's about a little girl who moves to a new area along with her mother and is befriended by an elderly neighbor, and the elderly neighbor is not well, and it's about resilience in the face of loss and
something we all can relate to in these pandemic times.
Yes, exactly. And the pictures remind me of Keats's Snowy Day. It's simple, and yet it perfectly goes with a very simple text that tells a story.
Now, I notice the text here is smaller than in the other book. What age range would this be for?
I would say ages 2 and up.
Oh, okay.
When I say up, I mean 2 to 5, 2 to 6. It's Oho's first snow. We toboggan until my snowsuit is soggy, and Oho is covered in tiny snowballs, and that's her dog. After we warm up with Mom by the fire and then help her finish making salmon stew to share with Agnes. And it goes on to talk about her day and her experiences. But it follows her emotional journey, and it's powerful.
I'm so impressed that there are books to help children through grief and with loss and with reconciling their place in the world after a tragedy. Because I know I'm retired now, but when I was young, I had a friend whose sibling died, and she said people just ignored it, ignored her, just went on as though nothing had happened. So it's so wonderful to see that there's more acknowledgement that young children have very strong, powerful emotions. Yes, I need to think about it.
That's important, and I do believe there's a growing awareness of this fact, and you can see it in the books. We have a lot of books about dealing with loss for children of various ages. And one of the services that we provide is we offer reader's advisory. Anytime that we're open, you can come in and say, you know, I'm looking for a book on this theme, or my child is struggling with something. Chances are there's a book for that.
That's wonderful. And what else do you have for us?
I have a story. It's a compilation, actually, but it's called Intertribal Stories for Kids. The title is Ancestor Approved. Intertribal Stories for Kids. And it's a collection of Native American authors. And I should mention that all the books that I have, with the exception of one, are written by Native Americans. And these books have also been vetted by Debbie Reese. She's an American scholar. She's a Nambi Pueblo scholar and educator, to be precise. And she has a blog called American Indians in Children's Literature, and she analyzes representations of Native and Indigenous peoples in children's lit. And so I think it's important to recognize the authenticity of books by Native Americans about that experience. So I have a book that she co-authored called An Indigenous Peoples: History of the United States for Young People. And what she did was she worked on the adaptation, along with a woman named Jean Mendoza, of the book that was written by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. And this is a powerful book. I think it should be taught in all high schools in the United States. But it's about American history from the perspective of a Native American. And it's amazing. Another book that I have?
Yes, please.
Is Undefeated. And this is not written by a Native American, but it is written by Steve Sheinkin, who is one of my favorite authors. He wrote a book on called The Notorious Benedict Arnold. And so he writes about American figures in American history. And I would say he puts the human in history, because his stories, they read like novels or thrillers. And this one just leaps right off the page at you, but it's about Jim Thorpe and the Carlisle Indian School football team. And he went to a residential school, and as I'm sure you understand, those schools were schools where they sent young Indian children to deculturalize them from their Native American roots. And what was done to them was cruel and heartbreaking. But this is a story, this is a very positive story about Jim Thorpe, who was one of the greatest all-around athletes of all time.
And listeners of this program will be familiar with some of the discoveries, unfortunate discoveries of graves and treatment of natives in some of those schools. We've covered that in the past on our program, and we'll continue to cover that. So thank you so much. Carol has brought together a wonderful group of books. She also had one called Celebrate My Hopi Corn, which was a board book that she had a few words, both in English and in the Hopi language.
Yes, it's actually a bilingual book, and it talks about corn and the customs that go along with that in Native American households.
So these are just a very few of the books that are available for young people's services at Troy Public Library. It's a lovely room inside the library at 102nd Street in Troy. As you come in the entrance, turn to the right, and Carol is surrounded by beautiful books and other resources. Carol, thanks you so much for taking time to talk with us.
You really emphasize the sound of the books in there, and I know at some point you talk about the echo in the room. You travel every month to the library. And I think it's such an important part of your coverage of the library is to actually be in there and to hear the books being turned around, the pages flipping, and the sound of the space. How has this series been progressing since you began it last year?
we started out being comfortable with each other, but I think it's grown into a stronger familiarity, a stronger trust in each other. And having Chloe Whitaker come in, Stephanie Dudek was wonderful. Chloe Whitaker, I've done one episode with her so far, and she did a wonderful session on pulling together a number of books on social justice and for Black August. And so I'm really looking forward to continuing this series. I've also added The Bookhouse, doing an interview each month at The Bookhouse. I just did one, well, saying today won't help because I'm not sure when this program is airing, but I just did one in late September. And I'm hoping to contact a couple other places and talk with other independent booksellers. So there's such resources and such amazing, not big name stores around, Braveheart Books and Hudson and Dove. And so I'm hoping to connect with those too.
So we were talking about local independent media before. This is a part of the way that you support local libraries and small bookstores, right?
Local libraries, small bookstores. I want to do more with small businesses. I used to work with the Community Loan Fund, so I want to help promote the many small businesses in the area of other kinds as well. So yeah, it's just building community.
Well, thank you, Bria. And we're going to head to our last segment. And Blaze, you're a pretty recent addition to Hudson Mohawk Magazine, but you're quickly becoming one of our trusted policy correspondents to interview candidates. And you recently interviewed Rostislav Rar. Could you introduce the segment, please?
Yes. What we're going to hear is part two of our conversation about his platform and why he wanted to run and make change.
Rostislav Rar, in part two of our conversation, great to have you back. Let's talk about the environment, where you left off yesterday.
Thank you. It's great to be back. Yes. So as far as the environment is concerned, this is our number one issue for this campaign. Our slogan is environment, equality, education. Environment for us comes first. You know, we have an existential threat of climate change. You know, a lot of politicians, Paul Tonko included, pay lip service to that reality, but they do not take action in order to prevent it. So take our opponent, Paul Tonko, for example. He's voted against the Green New Deal on three separate occasions. And at the same time, he likes to say that he supports the Green New Deal in principle. This is an excellent example of, you know, the establishment's hypocrisy. They say one thing and then they do the other. And at the same time, he takes money from, you know, corporate PACs and oil and gas industry, etc. So essentially, it's kind of useless. You have to really read the person's actions and not so much their words.
For sure. But, so you would never take money from those PACs, and you think that supporting something in principle as a concept and actually not voting on it, in your view, those are two different things?
I would, first of all, never take money from any sort of oil or gas industry or coal industry, or I would hesitate to take money from any lobbyists, for that matter. Technically, I guess, if you say I support something in principle and then you vote for it, it's not a lie, but it is, it feels a bit disingenuous, because essentially, you know, when I walk around this community and I talk to people, they all say, oh, Paul Tonko, he's great on the environment. And I'm like, well, why is he great? And they're like, well, we don't know what he's done or what he does, but you know, we think he's good. He says the right things. It's kind of like when politicians, they say something because they want people to vote for them, but they also want to have the money from the industry in order to scare away people like myself who might want to run against them. They kind of have to speak out of both sides of their mouth. And that's what people like Paul Tonko do all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean this as a cynical question, but what would make you different? I mean, I've heard, and anyone who's listening has heard the narrative that I'm not going to act that way. I'm not going to act that way. What makes you different?
Well, what makes me different is a few things. First of all, I think we're from different generations. You know, Paul Tonko spent 39 years in office now. When you've spent that long in office, and by the way, when he came into office, you know, the term climate change wasn't even a thing that people used, right? So throughout the time that you're in government, it becomes normalized. It becomes like, okay, yeah, I'll take money from this person. It's not going to affect my judgment on this specific thing. But it does. And I've seen it because I was in the assembly. I've seen politicians walk out of meetings with lobbyists and say, how much money is that person giving me? You know, that's sort of blatant, I don't even know what to call it, but you're really taking public trust and you're throwing it in the dumpster when you do that. And I think pretty much all establishment politicians do it. When you take money from these interests, it's never not going to influence your decision making. I pledge not to take money from those interests. And so, you know, when I say, you know, that our average contribution is, I think right now it's like $78 for this month. It's like average of $17. That's the people we're representing. We're representing the people who can afford to only give us that much money, right? That's really our base.
Which ties perfectly, Rostislav Rar. That ties perfectly into equity, doesn't it?
Yes. Thank you so much. So equity, or I should say equality, is the second part of our platform, environment, equality, education. So equality is all about asking the difficult questions. We have different people in this country treated so differently based on the color of their skin, their sexual orientation, on their class status, their income. It's really kind of astounding. So even in the course of this campaign, you know, I grew up in not my whole life, but in high school I went to Niskayuna, and throughout this campaign I've also spent a lot of time in like places like Arbor Hill, etc. And just even the way that the cops treat you so differently in these two places is very, very striking. So we have to ask difficult questions. For example, how come when we are building a toxic dump site, we're so much more likely to build it in a poor area of town as opposed to a wealthier area of town? How come our kids in poor communities of color getting so much less money for their education than kids like myself who went to Niskayuna High School? How come we have trees in wealthier suburban areas planted and maintained, but we cut down those trees for, you know, crime prevention in communities of color and poor communities? So we have to ask those questions. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is we have to address them. So we do it through policy, right? So first thing first, how do we pay for all of our policies? We create a wealth tax. I support the Bernie Sanders proposal. We would tax the wealth of people who have more than $30 million at 1% and tax the wealth of billionaires who have more than $10 billion to up to 8% of their net worth annually. That would create enough money to pay for any kind of policies that we would want to enact, including equalizing school funding, making sure that all kids have the same resources, making sure that there are no food deserts, that no matter where people live, that they have access to affordable produce, making sure that they have access to green space that is easy to get to. Any kind of any kind of issue that has a dimension of equality in it can be addressed. So that's really, you know, that's really the basis of our platform is how do we make a more equal society?
What else would you like to add in about a minute and a half that we haven't mentioned yet?
Okay, so I'll just give you an update on where we are and where we're going. So as I've said repeatedly, you know, our campaign is going to be vastly outspent by Paul Tonko. So we really have to count on the passion and courage of volunteers. So if people want to help, there's so many things you can do. First of all, you can just tell people about us. You can remind people that there's an election going on August 23rd. In this election, you know, only about 10% of voters in off-year primaries actually go out and vote in New York. So in this election, it might be even less than that. So your vote really matters. So really, please take the time to vote. Even if you choose to vote against us, go out and vote. It's important to vote. And remind people to vote, remind people to participate. And if you'd like to help, you know, we're going to be out. We're going to be hanging out, handing out flyers. We're going to be hanging up flyers. We're going to be live streaming our canvassing on Instagram and TikTok. So tune into that. We are really trying to leverage social media as part of this campaign to overcome some of those funding barriers. You know, donate $5 to our campaign. Whatever you can do, we can use the help. So, yes, thank you for listening.
Well, Rostislav Rahr, thank you very much. Rahr for Congress, that's R-A-R, the word for, F-O-R, congress.com for more information and to get involved. Rostislav Rahr, what an absolute delight to have you here on Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Blaze. It was an incredible pleasure.
So that primary election is behind us, and Tonko was the winner of the Democratic ticket. So, Blaze, what is important when doing election interviews?
I think what's important about not just election interviews, Sina, but political interviews, is to give them a little bit of breathing room, but also be able to reel the candidate in. Otherwise, they're just going to, you know, and then you lose control of the interview. That's not what you want to do. I felt with this particular interview with Rostislav Rahr, why I chose it, because truthfully, that was the first congressional interview I've ever done. And I treated it no differently than I would anything else. But it's important because you want to make sure that you are touching on things that are important to everyone beyond what the platform is for that particular politician. And that applies on both sides.
One of the things I like about this program is that we give politicians time. It's not just the 2-second soundbite, the 10-second soundbite, but that we have time to ask questions and push a little bit and push back a little bit. So thank you for that.
We do have to wrap up our show. So I just wanted to ask each of you if you have any last thoughts about the importance of Hudson Mohawk Magazine in its fifth year.
I love working with Blaze. I mean, when we get joking in the show, it's not fake. It's that we really enjoy working with, or I really enjoy working with you. I'm not sure what you would say to that, Blaze, but it's been a wonderful opportunity to meet great people who are committed to the community.
Bria, simply put, ditto, because I love the fact that we have just this authentic relationship as we're on the air and doing our show. I think we do the very best that we can, and we continue to get better and iron out the wrinkles.
And that's our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sina Bazile-Hickey, joined by our incredible producers, Blaze Bryant and Bria Barthel. Thank you so much. This is a volunteer-run program, and we appreciate all of our producers who make this show possible. Thank you for celebrating 5 years of Hudson Mohawk Magazine with us. If you would like to get involved, please email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or go to mediasanctuary.org. For more information and our full archive of stories, you can find it there. Thank you so much. We appreciate you. Thanks for tuning in.